So those laws are instructive, and they're great examples for us. They help us understand justice, and they help us to understand God, what concerns, what is on God's heart for a nation. There's many laws in there that give guidance in turn, all the way from the commandments. We have the greatest commandment, 10 Commandments. We have all these laws that are outworking explanations of what God desires for justice, for mercy, all sorts of things. But they're for that specific nation. And so we wouldn't consider them to be guiding, binding laws that we should be seeking to continue the sacrifice, continue the Old Testament law today. And then we looked at, Jesus, one of the first times he was kind of tested with his role with the government, like how do you view the government, was the taxes, right? Mm-hmm. So what, do you remember, what was like the trap? There's two options, right? Should we pay taxes to Caesar or not? Mm-hmm. So what was the danger of either one of those views? Mm-hmm. What would have been bad if he had said, yes, just follow Caesar, we all should pay our taxes, what would it be?
One way, if he pays Caesar, then he's a traitor. The other way, he's a rebel.
Right, right. They wanted to paint him as one of those two things, right? Either you're a traitor, and you're not really a Jew. You're just another Roman. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So good. And then, do you remember kind of what was the key part of his answer there?
The image of the coin.
Yeah. So render to Caesar what Caesar's. To God was God's. Yeah. Caesar's image is on the coin. God's image is on us.
Yeah. And it's interesting how they had a coin.
Yeah, just right there?
Yeah, they were in possession of it. So clearly they enjoyed the benefits of Caesar's government.
Right.
They had coins with his image on it. So it's just kind of one of those, Jesus owning the room moments, which I really...
Like, hey, how about everybody pull out the coin that you have in your...
Exactly.
In your pocket. Okay, let's read 1 Peter 2. This is the bottom page 5. So if someone will read 1 Peter 2, 13 through 17.
Submit yourself for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority, or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. For such is the will of God, that by doing right you may silence the talk of it. Foolish men. Act as free men and do not use your freedom as a covering for evil, but use it as bond slaves of God. Honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king.
Yeah. So, looking at that, right, what's our key command? What are we commanded to do in reference to the government? Yeah, so we start submit, and then he gives it lots of explanation for the Lord's sake, right? And then later, in verse 16, he tells you kind of two things, right? Act as free men, and do not use your freedom as a covering for evil, right? So he's giving them this kind of balancing, right? You have freedom, but you need to use it in this particular way. And what's he say about like the role? What does this say about the role of government here? The role of the king or the government? What's their purpose?
Punish evildoers and praise those who do right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that as we kind of, that's been one particularly helpful thing for me is when we think about how involved we are in the government as Christians, we want to realize that the role of the church. We have a particular goal in mind. We have the Great Commission to make disciples. Whereas the government has this goal of, or purpose of, punishing evil and rewarding good. And so when we work in the government, it's often to help it do that purpose better, not necessarily to make the government into the church. Right? So we're not trying to establish laws that will convert people, in the sense where that's giving the wrong institution the wrong job. And what, we can get a little bit of rationale, right? So why kind of like same thing with Jesus. Why would we want to submit to the government? Because it gives, we don't want to give the Rome. What kind of accusations would that silence?
The rebel.
Yeah, those rebellious Christians. Now, did that stop Christians from being blamed for? It doesn't mean that if we submit to the government that we won't still be blamed. It just means we don't want to give them a just cause for blaming us. What do you think? How is that loving towards our neighbor? I mean, how are we obeying that command to submit to our government? Or you could think, how is it unloving to your neighbor to not submit?
Yeah, I think you look at who are the losers in anarchy. And it's the people who are weak and they can't fend for themselves. I think about if you're in a failed state, for instance, who usually rises to the top? It's a warlord.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not necessarily, they don't have a contract with the people. You know, their rule is established by the fact that they're able to, hire mercenaries, maintain their power, use violence to impose their will, which usually is to serve their interests, not theirs.
Mm-hmm.
So I think when you look at the alternatives of a government-free zone, it's the weak who really suffer.
Yeah. And it makes you real. I mean, there seems to be a kind of prevailing attitude that all power structures are used for oppression, and so right now that's kind of a attack on all power structures or authoritarian structures. And so you have to kind of pose the alternative, okay, if we take the power away from this group, who's going to wield that power, and are they going to be more just or less just in the way they administer that power?
Yeah. Yeah, and every once in a while you have a tyrannical regime or
mm-hmm.
the government, the criminals are the government.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in our household, we're on the Soviet Union kick,
yeah.
So we're learning all kinds of things about Stalin and the gulags and everything. But I think in general, if you murder, you steal. I mean, there's some classic crimes
mm-hmm.
that governments universally
mm-hmm.
prosecute and, to protect life and protect property and some of those things that, rare is the government that doesn't do those things.
Right.
And it's usually the government acts.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not in that kind of environment right now.
Yeah, and in much a similar way, I think the more the church and the more Christians that are good citizens, submissive to the government, it strengthens the institution of the government and gives them a greater kind of sway within the culture, because there's a witness among all the people that are surrounded that you're surrounded by people who are being obedient, submitting to the government authority. And in the same way, the more there are people that are rebellious, defying, high-handed, just, I'm not going to do this, that can spread as well. And so in a sense, it helps to legitimize the authority of the government when Christians submit to it and say, no, this is good to have a government, to submit to their rule and to their leadership. So, right, then how do we act when the government is not acting in a way that is godly? And maybe they're punishing the good and rewarding the evil. That's kind of the tough part. And I think what you mentioned, we are well aware that, it's the weakest that suffer, and the weaker they are, the earlier they'll suffer with government. And so we see that with our government and abortion right now. So what we're going to talk about then is how do we engage. How much do we engage? What means do we take to engage with the government and the political? We'll talk about government or political process. So quick, we'll run through some history here. Looking at page 6 there. You've got 1978, right? So 70s, 80s, 90s, we'll hit up a couple things. 78, they had the formation of the Moral Majority, right? Led by Robert Grant and Jerry Falwell. Mobilize conservative Christians to vote together for purposes of outlawing abortion, opposing state recognition to homosexual acts. The strategic says opposition to the Equal Rights Amendment. I wasn't sure. I didn't research why that was. Do you remember why that one was?
The Christian position?
Yeah.
It's not entirely clear to me. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I don't remember.
I think that's the one that erodes differences between the sexes in general.
Oh, okay.
It's where it would lead to. It's not what's in the amendment itself. It's where it would be taken.
Gotcha. Yeah. And then enforcement of traditional vision of family life and censorship of media outlets that promote anti-family agenda. So again, here it's kind of trying to push or define the lines of when we want the government to reward good and punish evil, like how specific do we want to be here? How specific do we want to be on family, you know, the roles of men and women, those type of things. So, you know, they were a big part behind her election in '80 that elected Reagan. And then, looks like, and I didn't read the expose, right? But they lost some influence there when they started to get reported on, right? In '88, I remember Pat Robertson was always on TV all the time in the '80s, '90s. Always on there praying for.
He says kooky things.
Yeah, turning away hurricanes and all sorts of things. But
all sorts of things.
All sorts of things. Yeah. So anyway, he teamed up with Ralph Reed to form Christian Coalition. You know, it's from '80s into the '90s, almost up to 2000. It's funny, yeah. Ralph Reed was the Christian face in the cover of Time. That's a different era. So. But they did, right? There was this real infusion of, you know, backing, voting. You know, they mentioned the voting guides were distributed to 40 million, through churches, which demonstrates the scope of the organization. So lots and lots of people were voting based upon the recommendations of this Christian coalition.
You know, what's interesting is where it kind of fell apart was... some casino lobbyist for, I think, for a tribe located in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it was in Texas, but we'll just go to Louisiana.
Somewhere.
Basically, hired Ralph Reed to try to get a legalization of gambling outlawed in Texas. So there was an amendment on the ballot in Texas where they were going to legalize gambling. And so they hired Ralph Reed, and Ralph Reed worked with the churches to oppose gambling in Texas under moral pretenses so that Ralph Reed would get a huge payoff.
Wow.
And so that became an example of how lobbyists were able, they basically availed themselves to be, you know, we will get Christians to vote a certain way to meet your interest in repayment for us.
Yeah,
for large sums.
Yeah, yeah, and I think you know it's a very good example. There's a few others that come across where you know many people, and we'll talk about this as one of the objections. But those who are not interested in the gospel and are living in rebellion, they are interested in political means and political power.
Yeah.
And so when a Christian begins to when we seek to achieve political aims and purposes, we're more open to someone pursuing alliances that are purely political in nature.
Right.
And when we form those alliances, then it makes it very difficult to maintain both competing goals.
Yeah.
Right.
The purity of witness can be compromised.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of the tension that you know, the closer you align with a group to achieve a political end, the harder it is for you to speak against that political group.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a tough. So even in 2000, right, they elected George W.
Mm-hmm.
Right, he's an evangelical. When Bush prevailed in 2004, many pundits conceded that the evangelicals in Ohio and Florida were the ones that swung the election. I remember Florida got called like four times. Back and forth. And Florida is Gore. No, it's Bush. No, it's... Well, it went back and forth, and several months later, right? So then it moved, right? The leaders in that time were Dobson, right? Continuing to fight for unborn, outlaw homosexual marriage, big push towards the marriage amendment, trying to get that amendment to the Constitution defining marriage as man and woman. So that's kind of been our a little history of political engagement over the last 30 years, 40 years.
Yeah.
So I guess one question is, like, what is our goal? Like, think about what these groups were trying to achieve, right? Is it a good goal? What was their goal? And what do you think our goal should be? Why do you think, what was motivating them when we were trying to achieve these ends?
That's a dangerous thing to say, because it could go one of two ways. It could be either this guy realized, hey, I could use this to make myself rich. Well, this Reed fella, they either realized that, or they either started out with good intentions.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's interesting when you look at the equal rights, or you look at the moral majority's agenda.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you're to look at it, it's definitely a majority take on the issues, right? Censorship, outlawing certain things. I think right now we have a minority concern.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot more concern about religious freedom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, can we still practice our faith and keep our jobs,
mm-hmm.
even if we're not LGBT affirming, for
mm-hmm.
instance? But the pro-life is kind of like, that's probably the
right.
the galvanizing thing all across the
mm-hmm.
decades that has kind of kept us united.
Yeah, and I think it the goals of then versus today seem to reflect kind of the way that the church views itself in the relationship of the context of the culture and the way the culture is viewing. I think in that those times there was a little more belief that the Christian worldview was the majority view
mm-hmm.
of the country,
mm-hmm.
and it was to prevent the country from taking a different view of the world and of life
mm-hmm.
and of family and government.
I think because, like, what sets our circumstance apart from just reading scripture and being able to find our answers there about what our engagement should look like, the big difference is that from the outset, our contract, right, the contract between government and governed is that this is a government of the people, by the people, for the people.
Mm-hmm.
And so as the people, we are responsible for the character and the actions of the government.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's that sense that as a Christian, whatever my, you know, 1/350,000,000th
mm-hmm.
responsibility is,
mm-hmm.
I need to do whatever I can to have a righteous government that pleases the Lord
mm-hmm.
and that prevent, you know, that rewards good,
mm-hmm.
punishes evil, all those things. And so I think that that is what really motivated this whole movement of people to come together and say, well, how do we vote together to do this? Because it's our responsibility, particularly if you see yourselves as the majority,
mm-hmm.
That we can't be silent and, you know,
right.
let the tyrants run away with it.
Or right. right.
And so I think we feel that less now because we're in the minority.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we feel that a little bit less, and that we can do protest votes or whatever instead of feeling really responsible. But I do still think that that's the difference between simply submit to your government and
mm-hmm.
what we face, which is basically your government is of you, by you, for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and I think it doesn't diminish. I would say it doesn't diminish our burden and responsibility necessarily, whether we are majority or minority. You know, we still have the same obligation to, you know, that's the government that God has placed us in. And so we have been given that freedom, gift, responsibility, whatever you want to call it.
Okay, I got a question.
Yeah.
What do you guys say about the people, this movement in Christianity that like's happening, that they're like, oh, you're just a one-issue voter. If you just vote for abortion, you're just a one-issue voter. I don't believe that, but
mm-hmm.
people, especially this time, say that.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's bothersome that there's such a split in the church now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, one way to think of it is, and you know, Dave sent me a really great article. I can maybe send it to you. But when you weigh issues, you know, a candidate or a party might, yeah, we like this part on this, but not every issue that is for and against is the same weight.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the thing. Like, sometimes candidate A, I might have five things that are in their favor, right? But if I have one thing that's against them that's so big and so heavy, it might outweigh 5, 10, 20 issues,
right,
which I can align with them.
Right. And if you think one way on abortion,
vice,
it's going to trickle down.
Right? Vice versa, if I have a candidate that's right on abortion and they're the only one that's right on abortion, that might outweigh lots of other issues in which I disagree with that candidate. So I think that depending upon the issue, like abortion is a great example, it's okay to vote primarily on that issue because it's life and death, and the scale
right.
of which is life and death.
Outweigh other issues, you're right. Yeah. I don't know.
I think it's a good question to ask because, say, if you go to Great Britain or other, if you reach a point where all candidates are pro-choice but to differing levels, then you have to make the choice. Do I vote for the candidate who's more restrictive on abortion even though they're in favor of abortion in these circumstances, right? Because you're weighing, is it better to protest and say, I won't vote for any form of abortion when you know that it reaches a point.
Those are the only options.
Right. Those are the only options.
Yeah.
So it's tricky.
Yeah. I'm kind of disgusted with a lot of Christians, actually. I feel like they feel like they're living in this elite thing that's above the earth and they don't have to really be involved in their government. Like, they just want a perfect world. They want, I think, social justice is a problem. I don't know. Do you think that that's weighing in? And I feel like they're not...
Well, I think there's one sense in which people are, they get frustrated by the fact that they see that the political process or whatever, it's not achieving this perfect ideal that they would like to have. And so they're reluctant, to participate knowing that they see kind of this blend that, you know, if I do this, then I'm somehow compromising my conscience. Whereas, you know, the government has a separate purpose and a separate role.
I would say that when they say one-issue voter, abortion is not just a single issue. It's a way of seeing the world where you don't see abortion as murder. Yeah, so that's always a question I want to ask when people say that. I just say, is abortion murder? Well, it's wrong. It's not. You know, they'll say it's wrong.
It's sad. It's a tragedy.
It's sad. It's a tragedy. But is it murder? And then, well, no. I said, well, that's the difference.
Yeah.
Because if you see it as murder, then it's really hard on the hierarchy of injustices to say we shouldn't oppose it with all our being.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? So it's when they say one issue voter, it's they usually diminish abortion and then they exalt something to say that this is actually a more pressing concern.
Yeah. And
why don't you care about the people who are alive?
Yeah.
I think what's more concerning is there's many that are even now acknowledging it's taking a human life, but that's not, that life is not as important.
Yeah, that's
as this
true.
And they divide, so there's a worldview.
There's this view
that justifies it. And a lot of times, you know, people, I think, back into you know, they back into acceptance. They kind of buy everything else except for this one piece. It's like the college student who's always the designated driver, you know, for her partying friends. You know, eventually she's going to join them.
Right.
Eventually she's going to join them. And so that's kind of, so I think it's the assault on the worldview and just recognizing what that is and what people who advocate that do to justify it, to say that you can partner with them and be uncorrupted in the other areas.
Mm-hmm. What I often ask people, especially people who claim to be believers, is the Christians living in Germany, Third Reich Germany, Hitler offered the best vision of a society for those who were deemed acceptable, right? The only problem with it is you had to get rid of these people who were not acceptable, not just the Jews, but he had whole categories.
Mm-hmm.
But he did offer the best social programs, the most patriotism and pride and got people excited about life again and, you know, rule of law and all these things, whereas they had been in chaos and poverty, right, after World War One. And would you support that man if you knew what the cost was for this group, just this group, but everybody else would live a better life than under this alternative? And everybody universally says, no, that's horrifying. And that's really the same question. We have to kill this class of people in order for us to live this good life and pursue these goods together with us who are acceptable and worthy. And so I have absolutely no problem saying, I'm a single issue voter because this is the atrocity of our times.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean I vote for everyone who's pro-life. Sometimes I don't.
Mm-hmm.
But that means that I will not vote for candidates who are pro-abortion if there is any sort of viable alternative.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a clear distinction, too, that sometimes it's much easier to determine what not to do as a Christian in political engagement, and it's much harder to determine what to do. So, for example, in elections, many times there's people who you can easily say, I cannot vote for you,
mm-hmm.
right? But then out of who's left, who do I vote for, right? Sometimes that's the harder part. Because, sometimes the options aren't, aren't awesome, right? But you do have to pick.
You have
every choice, even not making a choice, is a choice.
Right, exactly.
So you're always responsible for what you do with your choice.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Okay, let's look at... What's that?
I know, I'm kind of stressed these days.
Let's look at some of the... Okay, so kind of the way that we've organized is we have some arguments kind of that are more against being engaged politically and arguments for being engaged politically, right? And so if you were to hold every one of the arguments against political engagement, you would be kind of in that group that, right, we're just going to be separate and not do anything. And the fewer of these hold would, right, you would maybe be involved a little bit, right? So we all kind of exist on this spectrum. We're trying to figure out, is there any value to any of these arguments? What's the value? What's the scriptural support behind them? What are the flaws with any of these arguments? All right, so let's look. So, right, number one, you must choose your kingdom. No man can be servant to two masters, for he will love the one and hate the other. Since the Bible clearly teaches, by the way, what was the context of that?
Money.
Money, all right. That might matter. So since the Bible clearly teaches that we are citizens of the heavenly kingdom, we should disengage in the affairs of the earthly realm. To state it more strongly, allegiance to this earthly kingdom is tantamount to treason against God. Let's start there. Any kind of flaws, right? This might be one of those logical fallacy that my kids are learning to detect.
That's right.
Right? So they say there, since the Bible clearly teaches that we are citizens of the heavenly kingdom, then that must automatically mean we should disengage in the affairs of it. What's the problem there?
We're citizens of both.
What's that?
So we're citizens of both.
Yeah, it's like there's not more than two options,
mm-hmm.
right? So it's kind of that giving a false dichotomy, right? If, since this is true, well, okay, we can't do anything here. All right, good. So there might be a way in which you can be citizens of both, right? That's what we would argue. So number two, our chief responsibility is evangelism. So obedience to the Great Commission leaves little time to trifle with the affairs of this world. Besides, the best way to change society is to lead individuals to Christ. What do you think of this one?
How busy are you really with evangelism? I'm not that busy with it, I'll be honest.
Is that the reason why you're
reason?
Not politically? And it does say little time to trifle with the affairs of this world. And I think that one of the problems that we run into is that we see it as all or nothing, right? In which, in reality, there is a huge spectrum of how you can be involved in your community and in your government. You can, you can vote for a party every time. You can read and research. You can be a part of the primaries, right? There's lots of different ways in which you can become more and more, right? You could run for office. You could support someone who runs for office. And in the same way, there's lots of ways in which you can be involved with sharing the gospel, right? And evangelizing. And I think one key thing that I would say that's valid is we don't want our political involvement to exceed the amount of which we are participating in making disciples and sharing the gospel. Our primary purpose is evangelism. That's primary, but having something that's primary doesn't exclude other secondary ways in which we're participating in our government, in our society. But as a Christian, we do know that God is concerned with the heart more than the laws of the land, right? So we doesn't mean we are excluding one or the other, but we have a primary focus, and that doesn't exclude participation. Okay, well, Christian ethics are for Christians and do not apply to the world of political power. So secular society, which hates God, has little interest in legislating biblical morality. Such efforts are futile, and our money should be spent elsewhere. Thoughts?
It makes all of our life a lot better if they will legislate the book of morality.
Right.
I mean, you can't legislate heart change, but moral, moral issues benefit everybody.
I mean, I think the problem with this is that if Christian ethics are just for Christians, then that almost makes it like an arbitrary code that God gives us once we're in, as opposed to Christian ethics are really living according to the world God created and the rules he laid down for human flourishing, which apply whether you're, I mean, if you're faithful to your spouse and you're not cheating and all these things, even if you're not a believer, that is still conducive to human flourishing, especially in groups, right? If families stay together and children are raised by fathers and mothers and all these things. So I think that when you're looking at how to structure a government and society, you want to reward good and punish evil because that's good for all. And you want to kind of create the systems that are going to encourage homes where children are safe and women are safe to walk the streets and all those things. And that's Christian ethics.
Yeah, and I think if we're, if we push the details here, I mean, we're talking, if someone says Christian ethics or biblical morality, well, you have to legislate some morality. If you're going to reward good and punish evil, you have to have a standard by which you measure good and evil. And so if you take out Christian ethics, you're still going to be replacing it with, there's no such thing as a secular ethic, right? All value judgments are based on a philosophy or a worldview that's not materialistic in a sense. It can't just be deduced.
If Alexander Ocasio-Cortez today could define how to reward good and punish evil, this would be a scary world. It just would. So if you were going to take out biblical ethics, that's what you're going to be left with.
Okay, let's get a few more. We're doing good on time. Politics is dirty business. Consider the downfall of the moral majority and the sordid career of Christian Coalition under Ralph Reed. I was also going to mention that we had talked a lot about like Ralph Drollinger. There's Capital. The first one is Capital Commission and Capital Ministries, and it's just this. There's a lot of stories of those who seek to influence the political realm for Christ, and the more they're surrounded and in there, eventually many of them are corrupted and it's become these visible. So there's some truth in that. It's a dangerous, spiritually dangerous thing to be surrounded in those realms of power. It is a dirty business and it is dangerous, but you know, Christ doesn't say to avoid anything that's dangerous.
Christ says war.
Yeah. So it's just that we want to be aware of that danger and take precautions to do things in a way that can serve him, even though it is dangerous. Right. And dangerous ecumenism. Since the only way of having genuine hope for change is to vote in bloc with other believers. Such an activity may lead us to compromise some of our doctrinal commitments, uniting us with denominations which we would otherwise oppose theologically, so i.e. Mormons. In other words, if we want to achieve a certain political goal, is it worth uniting with more and more theologically different groups if they have the same political ends? What do you guys think about that? Is it worth it? How far should we align?
Government isn't our church, so.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess just take into account, what is the nature of the alignment? You know, in what way do you, just because you vote along with some other group that also votes for that, that's not necessarily an alignment. So do you, you know, join in a coalition, right, and say, we stand together with these people on this issue? Or, you know, how much do you go come to conferences and speak at the same conferences and say, we're... So there's different levels at which you can choose to align or not. And there's a lot of wisdom there in deciding, you know, being clear, we agree on this issue and we're going to vote this.
Yeah, I think you have to define the issue. And, like, if religious freedom is going to be our new value, then we may have to walk back a few things. Like, remember the whole building a mosque in the shadow of the World Trade Center.
Right.
Yeah, it takes some thought.
Mm-hmm.
Like, maybe that wasn't a good thing to oppose.
Right.
Or the government to discriminate against one religion. So, I mean, there might be some uneasy alliances that, and anytime you form an alliance and you want to keep the team together, I think you saw this with Dwight Eisenhower in World War II, where he had to make sure that Montgomery was the one who took Italy, not Patton, because he wanted to keep an English prima donna happy.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so anytime you do have ecumenicism, there is some give and take. You have to give benefits. You have to keep people on the same team. So I think this may not be a reason not to do it, but you have to acknowledge that there is a danger to any ecumenical movement that you have.
I almost forgot. It reminded me of a passage from, we've read through the Book of Martyrs, and there's a section, Persecutions in England, I thought was interesting, that he's talking about during King Edward III's reign, and he talks about how the light of the gospel had been extinguished from the official church, and Wycliffe's followers, the Lollards, had become so many that the clergy was annoyed. Mm-hmm. Though the clergy molested them in underhanded ways, they had no authority to put them to death. Right? So there was this battle going on over theology. And after the usurpation of the English throne by Henry IV in 1399, the Lollards were subject to increasing persecution. Soon after, the papist clergy prevailed upon the king to introduce a bill into Parliament to condemn the Lollards, who remained obstinate in their reformed beliefs, and turned them over to secular authorities for burning as heretics. Right? So the church, right, the official church, the papists, right, they sought the political power, and when they got that, right, how was it used? It was used directly against the rebellious, right, of the church. And so there's this danger, right, when we, you know, the more we want government involved, do we really want them involved, right?
Mm-hmm.
Would it be better to have them using, you know, I think that's the danger, is that sometimes we want government to take up power on our behalf, not realizing that
they're still gonna have it.
Once they have that power,
ding,
it's going right back against you as soon as it goes to the other side.
Yep.
And so as much as you know, even though it would be so nice sometimes to think, let's just legislate this, as soon as the government just doesn't want to let go of that power. Mm-hmm. And so as much as possible, you know, keeping the church separate and allowing the government to punish evil and reward good.
Yeah, this is a pretty, it's a complex issue.
Okay.
I admire the way that Al Mohler does this, though, where he'll go and speak at BYU,
mm-hmm.
and he'll say very clearly, I am an evangelical Christian, I have a different gospel than you do. Here's an issue that we agree on that I'm going to bring you our perspective on.
Mm-hmm.
And he's able to speak into that because we do agree on all of these things that they've invited him there to talk
mm-hmm.
about. You know, it's just like the Chinese government inviting explicitly Christians to come and teach in their business schools,
mm-hmm.
because Christian ethics and business ethics go together.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I'll walk with you to that point,
mm-hmm.
and then here's the line.
Mm-hmm.
But I will walk with you all the way up to that point,
mm-hmm.
and speak the gospel and the Christian
mm-hmm.
worldview, plant seeds all the way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just think that that's exactly
yeah.
what we should do.
And then Lord will, he will save you clearly.
Yeah.
We have major
this is where
disagreements
we disagree.
On this issue,
mm-hmm.
just so you know.
Yeah.
Just so you all know that I know about these differences.
Yep. And
yeah.
they're important. But
then
on this
key.
Issue, we're
yeah.
different.
It's key, because people will need to hear that and understand, you know, because I think there's a lot of people outside the church and inside the church that aren't aware of, you know, what is the difference?
Right.
And so they need to know that, okay, what's the difference?
Right.
And that can sometimes be a kind of bring a light to, well, what is the difference?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a great opportunity to say that. But again, it is a way of engaging, but it's that walking that line of engaging and maintaining a distinction, you know, so engaging in the political process, but not moving your identity out of Christ into a certain political candidate or party, right? Okay, I don't have my watch.
We got 5 minutes.
5 minutes, oh.
I'll give you signals.
Give me signals. Christ will return soon. We better get busy with the business of the kingdom. Okay. Is there any reason why we can't participate in the government?
Well, I'm glad that believers didn't say that in 1776 and thereabouts.
Because he's returning soon, yeah, for the last 2,000. Yeah, that's true. And I think, I think we talk about it a little bit again later. But yeah, I mean, we go to church, but we also go to work. There's a lot of things that we do to maintain our existence individually, to maintain our income. And so it makes sense that we would carry that out to maintain our country, our government, that we can continue this for as long as it needs to happen.
Right?
Right?
He may return soon.
He may, yeah. Yeah. And knowing that working to maintain, there's a difference between working to maintain it and working to, like, stay here forever and perfect it.
Yes.
So there's a distinction that you can make there. And then let's maybe got God's sovereignty. By looking to human means to reform society and establish Christian values, we have denigrated God's sovereignty. I think that one's fairly clear, right? That we've talked about how God's sovereignty includes human means, right? He uses us. So you got pursuit of comfort in Phariseeism, you can look at too. I think number 10, we know we make unnecessary enemies. By making activism our priority, we fashion a reputation as rabble-rousing malcontents and foster hostility toward unbelievers that alienate us from them and us. You know, I think that there are many examples of wrong ways to engage. And I think that this is one of them, you know, because I do know lots of individuals who will claim Christianity, and in lots of other areas of their life, just totally act contrary to that. And politics is another way in which I've known people that will do that. And so it is possible to make enemies and to, you know, give Christ a bad name, but that doesn't mean that it's a necessary part of being politically engaged. And I think the difference, too, is are you becoming an enemy because of your stance, or becoming an enemy because of the way in which you're sharing your stance?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's, a lot of times, we think, oh, it's just they are opposing God, but we're like super rude and, you know, just name calling. Like, if we share it in the right way, then we can do that. And know that, yeah, we are going to make some enemies, but we don't have to do it all the time, right away.
And I think some things are just foundationally offensive. Like, if you're pro-life,
exactly.
You're basically telling every woman who's had an abortion, you are a murderer. You've murdered your child. You know, that there's no way around that. I mean, that would be deeply offensive to somebody
mm-hmm.
who disagrees with us.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way with LGBT, when we say that is wrong, that the marriage is illegitimate, the way the society is rigged right now is we are basically denying their humanity. And so some of our, I mean, there is a cost to our stance where people will be offended, and and there is a sense where you'd rather have them be offended by the gospel.
Yeah.
But, I mean, they are being offended by God's law.
And I think there's a sense in which, you know, the disciples that are that we're going to make of those who are lost, you know, they will be offended, but some of them will then, that offense will lead them to eventual repentance and faith.
Yeah.
And so while we are aware that we're going to offend them, we also want to be aware that some of them may be open to the gospel by someone who is, how can this person be so nice and sweet but say such offensive things? You know, and be a caring type person that says these things that seem so harsh. Like, it creates a conundrum for them, much the same way that, you know, like our kids that come from where they only know Christians and they see people that, are they a Christian because they're really nice? And you know, like, no, they're not a Christian. You know, like, they don't understand how unbelievers can be nice people.
Yeah.
So the same thing for those who don't know Christ and don't know Christians. It's like, all Christians are this wicked, hateful people. So I want to give them, you know, the harshness and the offensive of the gospel, but not in that wrong way. All right, well,
yeah.
We will jump in with arguments for engagement next.